dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And it's a delight to say that we are joined by what I consider to be one of the great minds with respect to the challenges that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party and what we should do about it. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer, PhD. He is a man who has been in academic circles for quite some time, also influential for his publications, notably How China Sees the World, Han Centrism, and the Balance of Power in World Politics, and the forthcoming book, Understanding the China Threat. He is also an essayist of unbelievable productivity. Many of his pieces published at The Hill, but in other outfits, I believe Epoch Times and beyond as well. He is a tremendous resource for the Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which he is a founding member, I'm pleased to say. And of course, a very, very welcome guest here always. And it's good to have you back, Brad. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us here at
Secure. Thank you, Frank. It's Secure a great Freedom pleasure Radio. To join you again.
Thank you. Let me ask you, first and foremost, for your sense of how the balance of power is being affected at the moment by what Vladimir Putin is doing in Ukraine and its knock-on effects in Europe, of course, but also with respect to the subject of your extraordinary expertise.
Oh, thank you, Frank. That's the key question. The United States needs to be laser-like focused on China because China is the threat of the 21st century. And in every action and event in international politics, the United States needs to consider the relative balance of power. Is an act or an event going to increase China's relative power, or is it going to increase America's relative power in international politics? So when we see the Ukraine conflict, we need to recognize that there are five centers of power in international politics. China, which is the enemy of the United States and its allies, Japan, warm relationship, of course, with India, and then lastly, Europe, and most notably there, Germany and France and the UK. The United States needs to ensure, and Russia, of course, is the last component there as a great power. The United States being focused on China and its prodigious threat to everything, liberal international order, the American homeland, American interests abroad, and the interest of our allies, needs to recognize that what we need to do is ensure that all of those centers of power are aligned with us against China. And thus, in the Ukraine context, what we're witnessing is this naked aggression that Putin has unleashed against Ukraine, with the approval, undoubtedly, of the Chinese Communist Party, led by the tyrant Xi Jinping, and coordinated between Moscow and Beijing before the conflict started. So what we are witnessing, of course, is that Russia is moving under the control of China. And to the extent that the United States can prevent this, the United States should. So the Ukraine war should be seen through the lens of the balance of power. Is this conflict going to make America more powerful? Is it going to contribute to America's might, or is it going to aid China? And thus far, it seems to be aiding China, and we have to work to address that and correct it.
This is a fascinating view, I think it's fair to say, and one that is obviously very much at odds with the general perception that Russia has emerged as an enemy of the United States once again by its attacks on a fellow democracy with whom, you know, we have reasonably friendly relations, if not alliance ties. And of course, the response of our actual allies in NATO, among the ones you've mentioned, others, in response to this brutal invasion ongoing, and it seems perhaps increasingly brutal invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin. Some would say that this ship has sailed, that Putin is already lashed up with Xi. In fact, that he would not be doing what he's doing in Ukraine were it not for his confidence that Xi has his back, as we talked about earlier in the program with Bill Walton. Walk us through again how exactly you see the opportunity, Bradley Thayer, for us to peel Putin away from Xi under circumstances in which most of the rest of the world is determined to drive him ever more into
Xi's
arms.
Well, thank you, Frank. That's a critical point. And you may be right that Putin is beyond the long arm of redemption in this conflict. He has, through his own actions, ensured that Russia is going to be dependent on China economically and increasingly under what will be a security umbrella, essentially provided by Beijing. That is a profound strategic mistake that many in Russia see, because they recognize the danger and even existential danger that China poses to Russia, as well as, of course, around the world, recognizing that this was a very significant mistake to tie yourself to the tyrant like Xi Jinping. So the extent that Putin is continuing to move in that direction, it just digs a hole strategically for Russia. The United States and its allies around the world need to recognize and to convey to Putin that what you've done in Ukraine is horrific. It's naked aggression that has a profound humanitarian cost for the Ukrainian people and others. But what you need to do is, in essence, reverse course. China is the threat, and you need to stand with us against the Chinese. If you continue to move in this direction, you will indeed be seen as a toady, as a lackey, as a dependent on China, and you'll be treated in that way. What Putin is doing is forfeiting.
Yeah, a vassal state,
yes.
In other words.
Putin is forfeiting Russian security. He's making a grand strategic mistake of the first order. It's a terrible mistake to ally with China. Not that he would be an ally of the West. Too many differences, the Cold War history and legacy. But Russia can be an ally of a kind against China. And we need to think creatively about how to structure that situation so that we can use Russian power against China rather than having China and Russia allied against the United States and its allies.
This seems to me to be eminently sensible. Again, the question that occurs is, has Putin made this mistake catastrophically, it would seem to me, and has, you know, China essentially locked him in, and that everything is now moving in the direction of intensifying that relationship. And I think, Brad, your assessment of what we should be doing instead raises a question. Is this part of a grand design by China and China's friends, including, I regret to say, the President of the United States, Joe Biden, to essentially help China achieve a kind of axis balance of power dominant position that is likely to conduce to its ambitions for global domination that you've warned about so powerfully in your writings, both in book form and in the periodical?
Frank, it very well may be that the case that Beijing does have a design for world domination, capturing Russia through Putin's foolishness and his recklessness and really his strategic idiocy. He's gaining Ukraine, but he's losing Russian sovereignty as a result of it, which is the game was not worth the candle. So from China...
Let me just ask you on this point, if I can, Brad, because this is sort of the crux of the issue for me. Putin is widely considered to be a pretty savvy guy. Some say he's ill, some say he is mentally unstable, but his record over the years has been one of a pretty shrewd, if ruthless, operator, a thug, yes, but someone who prizes himself as a master of chess, for example. If Putin doesn't see things as you do, that namely his country's long-term interests do not lie with China. China is going to eat Russia at some point in the foreseeable future. One would think that he would have played this hand differently before now. Do you have any idea what his thinking is on how this is going to work out, other than with the end of Russian sovereignty and far from the great Russia or the Russian Empire that he's fancied for so long, he's going to lose it all?
What he is doing now is going to ensure that result. We can certainly consider that his calculus might be that he'll be able to absorb part or all of Ukraine as he has regenerated Russian interest in the Caucasus and control over Belarus. But then turn against China. And that is basically, if you will, he's been tacking one direction and he'll reverse towards the West. If that's his calculus, I believe he's sorely mistaken, given the legacy of the Ukraine war is going to be a very viable consideration and memory for the Europeans and for the United States for a very long period of time. So if that is his calculus.
And he will be on his own at the tender mercies of China, presumably. Yeah. Brad Thayer, we are out of time, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us for a proper hour-long conversation in the very near future if we can. This is a topic we've just barely scratched the surface of, and it's your thoughts on it are provocative, but definitely in need of closer attention, especially in terms of our long-term strategic interests and whether we can get there from here.
Thank you, Frank. That's my pleasure. Question.
Thank you, Brad Thayer. Come back to us again soon, if you would. It's always terrific to have a chance to visit with you, and we look forward to doing so again soon. Next up, we will be speaking with...
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tomorrow, yet another vital nation may be lost if the people of South Korea decide to elect a pro-North Korea, anti-America communist as their next president. Or alternatively, if despite the majority's preference for his pro-freedom conservative opponent, this election, like the parliamentary ones of 2020, winds up fraudulently giving victory to the radical left. Either way, the outcome would be a further blow to America's strategic position in the world and boon to communist China's. Coming on the heels of the loss of Peru, Afghanistan, Chile and Ukraine in the past year, and the prospect that U.S. allies may be voted out in Colombia and Brazil in the next few months, our enemies will surely be further emboldened and our remaining friends destabilized. A generation ago, the question was, who lost China? Today, it will be, who lost the free world? This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, whom we are always delighted to visit with, but especially at a moment like this, when economic warfare is front and center in the efforts to penalize Vladimir Putin for his invasion of Ukraine and the horrors that he has unleashed therewith. His name is Bill Walton. He is a former very highly regarded capitalist on Wall Street, the CEO of a company called Allied Capital Corporation. He has gone on to other things, including these days, The Bill Walton Show, a terrific television podcast program that I commend to all of you. He's been active in conservative political circles as the past president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He is a regular here, I'm also delighted to say, at Secure Freedom Radio.
Frank, great talking with you.
Lots to talk about. In the aftermath of the invasion, European leaders, I think it's fair to say, principally have taken point on imposing a variety of sanctions on, well, Russia in general, its central bank, other banks, its capital markets, its the leadership and the oligarchs that prop it up. Even Vladimir Putin himself has been sanctioned. This constitutes, it seems, sort of economic warfare, as I say, against the Putin regime. Unfortunately, it does not seem, at least as of yet, to be slowing or otherwise reducing the violence that Putin is meting out to the Ukrainian people. Your thoughts about what's been done to date and what effect it's having, if any, and what needs to be done?
Well, the immediate reaction of the EU was quite good, and they slapped sanctions on Russia, and they began to cut off access to its banks. And with the United States, we've severely limited their access to $600 billion of reserves they had. Cut Russia out of the SWIFT system, which is the way banks communicate with each other to transfer money, and pretty strong stuff. Germany announced that it was going to start spending $100 billion a year on its own defense, which is sort of, you know, a jaw-dropping thing to hear. So the initial reaction had been quite strong, but the issue that we're really dealing with that has not been addressed is total sanctions on Russian oil exports. I mean, what's happened is the United States has talked about not buying Russian oil and gas, but it's clear that that's only a drop in the bucket for us. It's 8%, I think, of our gas and 3% of our oil. Europe, by contrast, 40% of its natural gas comes from Germany and or comes from Russia, and I think probably 15-20% of their gas comes from or their oil comes from Russia. So they're wildly dependent on it, and at this point, that has not been cut off. It's not been sanctioned, and it would if we were to limit Russian sale of oil and gas worldwide, we can do it by cutting them off from the banking system, imposing even more stricter sanctions on moving money than just SWIFT. SWIFT, you might recollect, is just really like a messaging system. It's not really the wire transfer system. We've done that successfully with Iran and could cut them off from moving money at all. Now, if we did that, the effect on Europe could be catastrophic. In terms of its energy prices and what happens to their economies, the effect it has here in the United States wouldn't be as dramatic, but it'll be extremely dramatic. And we're already seeing gasoline at $4 a barrel for regular $4 a gallon for regular gas. You know, that could easily go to $7-$8 a gallon if we impose total sanctions on Russia fossil fuel exports. And we have not done that, and that's the elephant in the room if we really want to be serious about stopping them economically.
Bill, there's a commentary, a narrative, if you will, that has been bruited of late that something we know has happened, which has been Vladimir Putin's support for various environmental groups championing this idea of weaning the West off of fossil fuels, specifically coal, and even nuclear power, which is not a fossil fuel, of course, but they've gone after that as part of the sort of incantation of the left and its energy advocates, all of which has had the effect of creating the kind of dependency that you've just described in Europe, notably, not exclusively, but notably in Germany, on these Russian imports of oil and specifically natural gas, to the extent that, you know, to put a face on it, Greta Thunbergs of the world have helped engineer this present vulnerability. It is striking that that Putin stands to benefit dramatically and continue to do so because, as you say, the costs of trying to wean themselves by especially a cold turkey cutoff of these imports to punish Putin for Ukraine would be so devastating in
The West is paying an enormous price for listening to a 15-year-old with a personality disorder telling us about how we ought to conduct our energy policy. The green agenda is a dagger aimed at the heart of the West, particularly its economy. But of course, if you have not a strong economy, you don't have other strong things in cultural institutions and politics and military might and freedom. So this green agenda is just something that is breathtaking in that Biden and his administration and John Kerry in particular, when they came in, one of the many things they did was they shut down the Keystone Pipeline, cut off our ability to drill for fossil fuels in the United States, and all the different things they did to put a chill on fossil fuels. Putin saw that, and he's been watching that unfold, and it's unfolded in a way that's increased gasoline prices here in the United States even before he invaded Ukraine. And he saw us sitting with leadership that was intent on bringing about U.S. strategic weakness. Remember, Lloyd Austin, Mark Milley tell us that white rage and climate change were the biggest threats facing the United States. Didn't even mention Russia, didn't even mention China. So we have unserious people in positions of leadership. Russia sees that. He's taking advantage of it. Putin's taking advantage of it. And China, with Xi, is just sort of laying back a little bit like Jabba the Hutt, waiting for his next move.
Well, if unseriousness were the extent of the problem, Bill, I wouldn't feel so bad about it. You can get more serious fairly quickly, especially if you're mugged by reality, as they say. The problem really seems to me to be that this administration is known by these adversaries, both Russia and China, to be compromised, to be seriously compromised by the corruption that Peter Schweizer has now helped document on the part of Biden and his family, among many others in senior ranks of the U.S. government. And I think that's operating here as well. And, at some point, the Chinese, certainly the Russians, may miscalculate on the basis of some of these assessments. But so far, I have the feeling that they think they've been vindicated in their calculations, that they can do what
they
will.
Agree with, more or less impunity. If you look at their individual biographies, backgrounds, many of them have been compromised, are compromised. But the biggest source, I think, is their belief system and the things they believe that just are not true. And, they're ignoring the fact that we are up against an axis, not just of Putin, but also of Xi and China, Iran, North Korea. And, while this is going on, the Biden administration is eagerly trying to get another deal with Iran, which would do a couple of things, but both of them bad for us. One of them, that would help Iran accelerate its nuclear arms development, but also it gives them a backdoor way to provide Russia with its own source of oil and gas should they need it. And so these actors, these bad actors, are working together 24/7. And Anthony Blinken doesn't see it. Lloyd Austin doesn't see it. Jake Sullivan doesn't see it, and certainly Joe Biden is clueless. So, so for all the people I hear saying we got to get tough now, Biden, Putin has murdered people, we got to murder him. Well, you got to think about who we have in our positions of power in the U.S. government who would actually bring that about, and this clown act is not able to execute.
Well, you neglected the ace in the hole, and that is Vice President Kamala Harris, who we're now sending off to Eastern Europe to try to navigate all of this.
I shouldn't laugh.
I thought when you were listening, bad actors, you were going to go through that batting order on our side as well. But Bill, one other that I just want to mention, you touched on him a moment ago, who is unquestionably playing a very substantial role in this administration's malfeasance, is John Kerry. And, he's a guy who negotiated substantially that terrible first deal with Iran. And one had thought it couldn't possibly get worse. I think, you know, with his help and encouragement in that portfolio, probably, but certainly in others, notably with respect to China and the whole, you know, Green New Deal enterprise on the international stage, well, a man who has serially betrayed his country in the past is still at work inside this administration, and it's just chilling, as you say, that our enemies are taken their measure, and I think are quite confident that they can do what they wish, as I say, with impunity. Bill, one other piece of this that speaks to the axis you're describing is the efforts that the Chinese are now making to give expression to commitments that they clearly made to Putin, well, certainly on the 4th of February when they signed this joint statement, he and Xi, but almost certainly long before that, to have each other's back. And I just wonder, as you look at the Chinese stepping in to try to help mitigate the impact of these sanctions and pull the Russians along on this the so-called SIPS program, which is a Chinese alternative to the SWIFT system, and otherwise advance their shared agenda of trying to de-dollarize the world economy. Are you sensing that they have the wind at their backs and that they are now not only confident they can get away with murder, literally, in their respective territorial ambitions, but that they have got sort of a working partnership that is likely to appeal to lots of others around the world and advance their own economic warfare strategies against
the United States? Well, this can only serve Russia or China's interest. I mean, they, you know, there's an attention economy or an attention strategic world we live in, and that we tend to pay to look at the things that are in front of us that are the biggest threats. And what Putin's done by going into Ukraine is he's changed the subject. And in a way, Biden's been a beneficiary because he's at 35-37% approval. And I'm surprised it's that high with all the catastrophic policy moves he's pulled off in the last year. China is really also a beneficiary. I mean, you've got, of all people, Rahm Emanuel, who's the American ambassador to Japan, has now been over there for a while, and he's recognized how egregious the Chinese loan-to-own program's been and how they've taken control of a lot of the strategic infrastructure in the Asia-Pacific region, but not only there, Africa and South America. So we have Rahm Emanuel, who seems to be the clearest thinker in the Putin administration, in the Biden administration, and he's sitting over in Tokyo.
We'll be watching him and the rest of this with your good help, Bill Walton. As always, thank you, and thanks for the great work you do at The Bill Walton Show. I commend it to all of our listeners. I hope they'll check it out. Bill, we'll talk to you next week. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, a friend of Peter, Bill's and mine, and a great expert on a threat that is now being bruited, possibly coming from Vladimir Putin, nuclear EMP. That and more, straight ahead.
Frank, ask Peter about where he believes Putin is physically right now. It's a very interesting answer to that question.
My friend, thank you so much. We're continuing our conversation with Jeff Nyquist, a very serious strategic analyst and a guy who's been following very closely what is happening in Ukraine, among other places. And Jeff, you were just saying that the calculation that Putin made may not have been a function of the sense that the United States and presumably the rest of the West would have no particular problem if he went into Ukraine. Finish that thought, if you will.
Russia, given the economic sanctions that they could have expected, and also the opposition and the future trouble, they could only have contemplated doing this if they had some kind of deal with the Chinese. China is an extremely powerful economy. This can support them economically. They have allies in Iran, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, other places in Africa. But China is the one that can give them the support. Now, what are the Chinese getting if they give this support? The Chinese have their own aggressive objectives. They've built the biggest navy in terms of the number of warships in the world. And March is a very good time of year for naval operations in the Western Pacific. It just happens. So I'm asking the question, did this happen in February despite the bad ground conditions because the Russians have made a commitment to the Chinese and the Chinese have their own plan for aggressive action this month?
That sounds right to me, Jeff, I have to say. So the idea would have been that there was a distraction by the Russians, get everybody focused on Europe, on Ukraine specifically, embroil the international organizations and the rest of the hand-wringers on that subject. And meanwhile, the main action is going to come against Taiwan in the form of an actual attack by the Chinese.
Well, you know that Taiwan is more likely to be defended by Japan and the United States than Ukraine would be by NATO. And so it was a safe bet, I think, for Putin, as long as he made lots of threats, like the nuclear war threat. Plus, you have the flagship of the Northern Fleet and the Pacific Fleet in the Mediterranean, strong task force that have to be watched by us. So we have naval. Yeah, this is Russia. The Russian Northern Fleet and Pacific Fleets are in the Med, and they're tying up our ships. They're tying up troops that were sent to Eastern Europe to watch this situation at the border, that it doesn't spill over. They even, the Russians, even accidentally on purpose, I think, on purpose, through the president of Belarus, Lukashenko, released a map showing that the Baltic states and Moldova are next in line. So this is causing us indeed to concentrate on Russia and air assets too. So that makes the Pacific more of a vulnerable spot to be next.
Yeah. Interestingly, it seems to me that one of the things that might prompt all of those assets being in the Eastern Mediterranean is Russia's determination to try to protect its allies there, Syria and Iran, imperfect though they may be, from an action by Israel, which is seemingly increasingly involved
they have,
as well.
Yeah.
But just coming back to China, Jeff, if the Chinese have decided not simply to try to coerce Taiwan into submission or envelop it, perhaps even by doing some movements to sort of encircle them with Philippine territory being seized. Is it your estimation at this point that sometime within the next few days, perhaps, or certainly weeks in March, that the Chinese will mount an amphibious operation against
Taiwan?
It is
possible. They have massed the troops for an amphibious operation. But I must say the Chinese leaders may be risk averse to an amphibious invasion, and they may prefer a blockade. And the reason that the good weather is important is that, you know, you can run a blockade in bad weather. So it may be a blockade, and maybe they'll invade if the blockade is not working fast enough. I don't know. But I would think they would do a blockade first because of, you know, watching them. They don't like to be defeated or perceived to be weak or losing. And a blockade is less risky.
Would you anticipate, Jeff, did you say that they are massing
troops? They've been putting troops opposite Taiwan here since the pandemic started. They started doing this and talking about invading in April of 2020, that war was coming, and that they alerted the army.
And they indicated, as I understand it, during roughly the time the president was doing his so-called State of the Union address, that they were there was nothing that the United States could do about Taiwan. And the clear implication is that they've set their sights on demonstrating that. So, Jeff Nyquist, let me just ask you in closing, when you look at this situation, whether it's in Ukraine, whether it's in the Eastern Mediterranean, whether it's in China's backyard, Taiwan, and so on, are we at the cusp of possibly a global conflict, World War III.
Seeing the reaction in Europe and in the U.S., I think we are. I think that the emotions are running high, seeing people being destroyed and countries being destroyed on this scale. I don't think the West can stop itself from wanting to intervene. And these powers have made a commitment to push out. So I think the combination of the two, I think at some point a world war, a major war between major powers is now inevitable.
Wow. And Jeff, one of the things that Vladimir Putin has done, as you know, in just the past few days, in response in part to the Europeans' retaliation against him for the invasion of Ukraine, has been to raise the alert level on his nuclear forces. There have actually been some statements to the effect that if there is a world war, it will be a nuclear one as well. Do you anticipate that that's what we're looking at, should it go?
Yeah, the Russian military doctrine is to go immediately over to nukes if there's a world war. Putin, that was one of the first things Putin did when he became president 22 years ago, is he adopted that doctrine. So I'm afraid it doesn't look good. You know, I mean, I don't know how they're going to avoid a war. Russia and China seem determined to push out. You look at Iran is about ready to break out with their nuclear weapons in a matter of weeks, I'm told.
Right.
And that may be why that Russian fleet is there leaning on Israel. So,
indeed, I think it is. And certainly why Israel's level of activity seems to be intensifying as well. Jeff Nyquist, these are grim tidings. Needless to say, I think we both hope you're wrong. I fear you may be right. And in any event, it's why we're here, is to cover these kinds of stories, take them where they lead. We'll look forward to visiting with you again in the near future for that purpose.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He's one of our favorites, Daniel Greenfield. He is a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, a very frequent contributor to Front Page magazine, and I commend to you his work at Sultan Knish and his blog at danielgreenfield.org. Daniel, it's good to have you back. Sir, it's been too long. Welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
I wanted to start by asking you about your take on the emerging Iran nuclear deal that the Biden team has pursued with what I can only describe as a monomaniacal determination in the face of all evidence that it won't help at all, and it will probably make matters considerably worse.
Joe Biden has a long history of being entangled with the Iran lobby. Going back to the 2008 Democratic primaries, he was actually attacking Obama for being too tough on Iran. He was extensively funded by them. His response to September 11th was actually a proposal to send $200 million to Iran. He's told Israeli leaders in the past that they should just get used to a nuclear Iran. So combine that with the old Obama hands who made the Iran deal happen, it's not surprising that we are getting an even more extreme and even worse version of the same bankrupt and arrangement that has absolutely no credibility whatsoever. And because so much attention is being focused on the situation in the Ukraine, almost no attention is being paid to what Biden is doing with Iran, which is, of course, enormously convenient.
When you say that the deal that they tried to, that they purported would save us from the Iranian nuclear weapon before, didn't have that effect. This seems to me to be, Samuel Johnson once said of second marriages, the triumph of hope over experience. What is driving these people? You suggest it's corruption in the case of Joe Biden. Is there something else that explicates what on earth makes them think this is advisable?
We are seeing the resumption of Obama's position that we have to conduct outreach to America's enemies. We have to cut deals with them, not because they are actually solving any problem, but because America is in the wrong, and the only way that we can repair that wrong is to actually make those deals happen. So the deals themselves are a pretext. What is actually the fundamental driving motive is the need to appease, the need to apologize for our existence, for our past foreign policy. Thus, we now have the arrangement to potentially buy oil from Iran, from Venezuela now. None of this is actually about what it claims to be about. What it's really about is resuming the Obama administration's policy, which is based on a worldview in which America is at fault. Now, claiming that Iran, that the deal was going to stop Iran's nuclear program when there's transparently not now more than ever, when it couldn't even stop it now, is again just a pretext for that underlying motive, because you can't come out to the American people, at least you can't politically do so, and announce that America's in the wrong and we must actually make amends. Rather, what you do is say that we have an emergency that requires us to urgently appease our enemies, and that is exactly what has happened with the Iran deal all along. And that is what is now happening with both Iran and Venezuela.
There's a lot to unpack there. One aspect of this is it would seem that this is a piece with, as you say, the Obama-Biden determination to fundamentally transform America, point one, and that a wrecking operation against it is the necessary means of achieving that. Domestically, we see it in so many different places, notably at the border, with our economy, you know, with our energy policies, and abroad. It does seem as though the leitmotif is emboldening our enemies, empowering them, enriching them, and diminishing or undermining our friends. A formula for having a lot more enemies than friends, obviously, a transformation of a very ominous kind. Anything you disagree with in that characterization?
Well, I think that is absolutely correct. The worldview here is not one of national security. It's not one that the United States needs to build alliances in order to protect our own security. Rather, it is that we must actually use those alliances to apologize, atone for our past. And thus, we have to actually abandon our friends who, because they're our friends, are clearly unfit, and reach out to our enemies who, because they're our enemies, are clearly our victims. This is the same thing that we're seeing in domestic policy, where we spend all of our time working with criminals and abandoning police officers that we're now seeing deployed at an international level.
You mentioned that Joe Biden had opined a while back to Israel that it just has to get used to an Iranian nuclear capability. Is there any evidence that the Israelis are taking that advice, and can they afford to do so?
What we have seen is that as a result of the Obama administration's policy, there was a growing closeness between Israel and some of the more old-line Sunni Arab oil states. This was obviously a very startling development, yet it was also inevitable because of the rearrangement of powers, of alliances that Obama had made in the Middle East. Under the Trump administration, this came through fruition through what people call the Abraham Accords. We are seeing that various players in the region, including Israel, are indeed growing closer. The Israeli government officials have made visits to Arab, Sunni Arab states. And this is not because there's some great moral awakening, because everyone has decided that they like each other very much. Realistically speaking, these are countries that have traditionally been Israel's enemies. But what they have realized is that the United States is absolutely unreliable as an ally under the Democrats, that when there's an Obama or a Biden administration, that they absolutely cannot be trusted. And the Republican administrations come and go. Thus, they actually have looked to form a somewhat more meaningful strategic arrangement with Israel. And likewise, that arrangement is based on Israel's ability to deter Iran. Thus, what we are seeing here is really a result of an alternative arrangement. We're seeing in these diplomatic visits by Israeli officials is that the Israelis and some of the Sunni Arab states are preparing to deal with Iran in their own way, because they know they can't expect anything from Biden.
Interposing of objections to them doing something about Iran, I think that's fair to say. And I guess this is the question that's sort of weighing on me, and I imagine on Israeli planners and some of these, partners in a marriage of convenience, one might say, elsewhere in the Gulf, namely that the United States might not only give forewarning of an Israeli effort to address this threat from Iran's nuclear program by trying to take it down through, you know, old-fashioned kinetic means, but may actually interfere with such an attack. Have you seen any evidence of whether the Israelis anticipate such interference and what they might do in response?
Once again, this is something that the Obama administration very much made into an issue. It surveilled, it spied on the Israelis, it leaked information about Israeli plans to attack Iran to the media. People tend to forget that even before the NSA Trump spying situation, the Obama administration was using the NSA to spy on members of Congress who were talking to Prime Minister Netanyahu at the time about opposing the Iran deal, and they were relaying the information to the White House. This was really the original Spygate that largely has been covered up. The Obama administration absolutely went into overdrive to protect its Iran deal. It spied extensively on the Israelis, including on Israeli military plans, resulting in, I'm sure, quite a lot of efforts by the Israelis to keep their plans private. I'm sure that is still the case now. Just because it's not in the media, the shadow game is doubtlessly going on. And the Israelis absolutely understand that anything that goes to our intelligence community is a risk of going to Iran and to Iran's allies.
It's so shocking, but it's of a piece, really, going back to what we were talking about a moment ago, Daniel, of the wrecking operation. When you think of the security and the strength that Israel enjoyed on January 20th of 2021, and compare it with where things stand now as a result of, you know, whatever it is, 13 months of Obama administration management or mismanagement of this portfolio, it's, I think, indisputable that Israel has suffered greatly, and that may be intensified if, as we fear, it has to take matters into its own hands to address this mortal threat to Israel without the help, the support, and perhaps even with the opposition of the U.S. government. Let me come back to another aspect of this, the energy piece. Daniel, it would seem that it is in the vital interests of the United States, especially at this moment when Russia's Ukraine invasion is wreaking havoc, not just in Ukraine, of course, but throughout the continent of Europe, economically, politically, diplomatically, perhaps militarily, that it would be in the vital interests of the United States, as well as Europe, to have other sources of energy being made available to Europe than those that Russians have on offer, Nord Stream 1, for example, and possibly Nord Stream 2 in due course. Yep. As with the American pipelines, Joe Biden has objected to an Israeli pipeline in the Middle Eastern Mediterranean that was intended to supply Europe with non-Russian gas. What are we to make of these decisions, seemingly very supportive of Russian exports of gas, but not so much anybody else's, at least friendly people like our own producers and the Europeans?
The administration's opposition to EastMed, which is an Israeli Greco-Israeli pipeline, is somewhat predictable because this is the same administration that sabotaged Keystone, that is consistently opposed to any kind of meaningful energy, sustainable energy program by our allies. And indeed, that effectively isolated Europe. It isolated Europe's energy needs. But this is part of the green dogma that the Biden administration, that a lot of folks on the left have embraced, which is that we need to be entirely dependent on solar panels and windmills, which effectively means that we're actually dependent on Russian gas and oil. That is what happened to Europe. It's why we're buying Russian oil in bulk. But also beyond that, opposition to EastMed, which would have been the Greco-Israeli pipeline, was no doubt motivated in general by opposition to Israel, opposition to Greece, for that matter, support for Turkey, and in the larger sense, support for Russia. Despite all the posturing now, the bottom line is that the Biden administration has consistently given the Russians everything they wanted. It was not all that long ago that the Biden administration was lobbying Capitol Hill against, mind you, sanctions on Nord Stream 2. Now that they're actually sanctioning Nord Stream 2, they're now actually lobbying against sanctions on Russian oil in general. So the Biden administration has been absolutely consistent in saying one thing and doing the entirely the opposite thing, which is, again, fairly typical when it comes to international relations and the approach to our enemies. On the one hand, they will claim with Iran, with Russia, with other enemies, with China, that they are absolutely opposed, that they are determined to protect American national security, but their actions show the exact opposite. And whether the excuse is green dogma, which, by the way, the Russians have very much financed, the Russians financed the various eco-lobbies and protests, so have the Chinese, or whether it's appeasement of our enemies, the consistent policy has been to put America last and to put our enemies first.
And to lie about it throughout, as was much in evidence during the State of the Union address, of course, that Joe Biden just delivered. I call it the gaslight of the Union rather than the state of it. Let me turn to one other piece of the portfolio you cover so well at Front Page Magazine, among other places, Daniel Greenfield, and that is your concerns about the release of terrorists by the Biden administration from Guantanamo Bay. This has gotten practically no attention elsewhere. I commend you for your work on it. Give us a quick update on what's happening there and its
implications. The Obama administration did its absolute best to free all the terrorists from Gitmo. One of the things people tend to forget is that Obama actually fired one of his secretaries of defense because he was not actually releasing terrorists from Gitmo as quickly as he wanted. Obama actually went to Congress and petitioned for the permission to just directly free all the terrorists himself, so he did not have to go through his secretary of defense and through the entire process of that. But some of the worst actually did remain in Gitmo. Biden is now releasing them. That includes one of the alternate terrorists for September 11th. So we're talking the absolute worst of the worst. So this was actually, we're including alternate 911 terrorists, people who were in the past would have been too controversial to be released. That includes the one of the terrorists from the alternate operation, which was originally Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who was the mastermind of September 11th. Contemplated multiple wings of the attack. One of actually would have come from Asia. We have one of the terrorists from that operation in Gitmo. He is being released. We have the 20th terrorist who actually tried to come in through Orlando, Florida. He was turned back. We have him in Gitmo. He's being released. A number of other key terrorist leaders, including one who plotted to carry out a major barracks bombing in Africa. Again, he is being released. So we're looking really at the very last few people who actually are the absolute worst of the worst. The Obama administration was not able to release them because pretty much nobody is paying attention to what the Biden administration is doing. They are being released.
I'm thankful that you are paying attention to it, and I hope that we can arouse others to do so as well. Daniel, this is a travesty, and it fits a larger pattern that you've described so well of really working against our vital interests, even our security interests. That seems to be the leitmotif of the Biden administration. Daniel, thank you for the great work you do at the Daniel Horowitz Freedom Center, and of course at Front Page Magazine, among other places. I know you keep it up. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.